to the Antimatter Radio Show, live from West Lafayette, Indiana, August 6, 2009. Today, as you know from my announcement last week, we have Walter Cruttenden, author of the book Lost Star and the founder of the Binary Research Institute. He's coming on the show. He'll be on in about 7 minutes from now. And that's, as of course all of you know, we've been listening to the show. We've discussed his book every single episode of the Antimatter Radio Show so far, because the book is one of the most profound books that I've ever read. It was as if I just fell into my lap. It was the information in that book was information I had been waiting for, and it was exactly what I needed at the time. It made all the dots come together and a lot of research that I've been doing, and we're really going to be honored here to have him on the show in a few minutes to discuss his book, Lost Star, and he's got a conference coming up, the CPAC conference, which is coming up by, I forgot the exact date, I'm actually going to be at that conference. It's this fall and out in Southern California. And a lot of experts in the area of research of what is called the Great Year, which is what Cruttenden's book, Lost Star, is all about, these cycles of history that we've discussed. A lot of the experts in that area of research are going to be at that conference. So it's something that all of you should definitely check out. If you're in the area out in Southern California, you should check out the conference, or if you've got a couple hundred bucks to buy a plane ticket and you can get out there, it's definitely worth doing, because this is what, I mean, a lot of you have known from listening to this radio show, that we seriously don't mess around on the Antimatter Radio Show. We really get to the heart of the matter, the big issues. I do a lot of reading, a lot of research, an amazing amount, actually, and I really sift through it all and clear all the garbage away and get to the real issues for you on this show. So when you listen to this show, you're getting serious information. We have a very empirical perspective on this show, so it's not a lot of theories, not a lot of guessing, and a lot of philosophy. It's a lot of hardcore information that you can establish for yourself, so you so you know that it's not somebody's wild idea that might be true, or it's, you know, it's not a theory that's true just because it sounds good or something like that. We all know that in the past, theories that just sound good, those are the ones that usually fall right on their face. You need to have verifiable information. You need to have data that all of you can perform on your own to do real science on your own to establish if something is true or not. Because if you have just a lot of theories, history shows us that that's where false information is derived. We have to have information that you can experience to know it's true or false. You need to be able to see it, carry out the experiments yourself. That's where the Antimatter Radio Show depends on, not on a lot of theoretical work. See, the academics, that's what they depend on. They depend on theoretical research, and that's why the academics very rarely make any kind of discoveries of any import. The news media will talk up the academics like they're just incredible and they're making all the big discoveries. But if you really go through on your own and make an honest survey of the research that the academics are doing and the discoveries that they've really made, you'll find that the academics, in fact, aren't really making any big discoveries at all. In fact, they can't explain almost anything. For example, our oceans on planet Earth are only about 500 million years old. Now, the Earth is 4.3 billion years old, according to a lot of researchers. And so that leads to the question, where did the oceans come from? And the academics, of course, don't have any answer for that. They just have a lot of guesses. Like, oh, they came from the comets. Like, all of a sudden, a bunch of comets hit the Earth 500 million years ago and created all these oceans, because comets are made out of water. That doesn't make any sense, because why wouldn't comets have been hitting the Earth all along? I want to make an announcement. Next week we have on the show James Nienhuis coming on. He's the author of Ice Age Civilizations, a book that I'm holding in my hands right now. I'm going to finish reading this incredible book by next week before he comes on the show. He actually is a person who holds the theory that the Earth is very, very young, perhaps just a few thousand years old. Now, this is an amazing theory, and it's I've been quite interested in this theory because some of the research that people put forward in it is quite stunning, and they're not messing around. They have some real information that people need to pay attention to. I'm not saying I subscribe to the theory in any way, but this is definitely a perspective that we need to hear. And James Neinheis, this author of Ice Age Civilizations, is coming on the show next week, has, in addition to that theory, he's got all kinds of other information to discuss with what are called Ice Age Civilizations. See, the academics tell us that there were not civilizations back beyond, say, 9,000 B.C. or so. We were all just a bunch of silly hunter-gatherers wandering around, very unsophisticated, just smart enough to hunt down a polar bear and eat it or something like that. But we have all kinds of evidence of civilizations such as Tiwanaku. Even the Sphinx shows us that there were massive, extremely advanced civilizations, perhaps well more advanced than us, that existed way back, further back than the academics will admit civilizations existed, which is back before 9,000 B.C. So James Neinheis on the show next week discuss these. He's the author of Ice Age Civilizations. So I think we need to get to our guest here, Walter Cruttenden. We're really honored to have him on the show. Walter, are you there?
Sure am, Jeff. How are you?
Good. How about you? Nice to talk
Excellent.
To you. Excellent. Yeah, Walter is the founder of the Binary Research Institute, and as we've discussed, he's the author of Lost Star, a book that discusses what is called the Great Year, these cycles of civilizations that we've discussed on this radio show. The idea that in the past there were civilizations that were more advanced than, or in some ways they had technologies that we can have evidence for that were more advanced than technologies that we have now. For example, civilizations in the past somehow built these things called pyramids and somehow could create a structure called Baalbek in Lebanon, which we've discussed in past shows. And our current civilization has no idea how to build these structures, so that leads to the question of how could past civilizations have built structures such as these. And then we also can look back through history and we see cycles of high points in history when these ultra-advanced civilizations existed, and then low points such as the Dark Ages when things seem to all of a sudden just fall apart for these civilizations. Their architecture and their structures fell apart, and interestingly, these are often the times when writing existed in the low periods, almost as if writing is something for a Dark Age or low-end civilization, as if higher-age civilizations had more advanced ways of communication that perhaps we can't even understand today. So also Walter has founded what's called the CPAC Conference, which features many of the experts and a lot of these ideas we discuss on the Antimatter Radio Show, and which you'll hear on this show today, and which are in his book, Lost Star. This conference, you can go to antimatterradio.com, and you'll see right there on the homepage an announcement for this show, and you can click through that and get to the announcement for this show, which will have the banner for the CPAC conference, which all of you should definitely look into. If you're out in California, you should get to this conference if you can, because if you want real information, real empirical information to know what has been going on in history in the past, to know how you've come to be what you are in this, how humans have come to be what they are in this current age, to know who you are by knowing your history. This is the best place to get information on that, so you definitely need to look into it. So if you can't make it to the conference, check out Walter's book, check out the Binary Research Institute. That's also an institute that Walter has founded to research these ideas that we're going to discuss in today's show and which are in his book, Lost Star. And let me just give you a 30-second summary, and then I'll turn it over to Walter. His book, Lost Star, involves the idea that the cycles in civilizations that we've discussed on this past show and which I just covered a minute ago are somehow also correlated with the Earth being, our solar system, being a binary system. That means that it involves two suns, two stars, not one, and they often rotate, they typically rotate around each other in some fashion. It can be many millions of years that it takes them to rotate around one another. And it's this progression of the binary system that our solar system is that is responsible for the cycles of history. That's what Walter's research at the Binary Research Institute involves. So, Walter, why don't you just tell us about yourself first and tell us how you came to a lot of these ideas and what your passion is in these ideas, and then let's get into everything else.
Sure, Jeff, love to. Once again, pleasure to be on the show. And, you know, as a little boy, I was very interested in history. And they taught us in school that everything is pretty linear, from caveman to modern man. And I had been reading a lot of books. My mom really encouraged it on very ancient civilizations, Babylon, Sumer, Akkad, Harappa, Mohenjo-Daro, etc. And I was amazed by the extent of their knowledge, the knowledge of astronomy and geometry and fairly sophisticated engineering, mathematics, that sort of thing. And yet all this seemed to go away during the Dark Ages. These civilizations went downhill to where, you know, Sumer, Akkad, Babylon, the whole Mesopotamia area, it turned to dust. They nearly became nomadic people. Same thing happened with Egypt. You know, many Egyptologists have commented that Egypt seems to be somewhat near its height at the beginning and then deteriorates over a long period of time until, again, it too is almost just gone to dust at the low point of the Dark Ages. So to me, I just had a tough time buying the linear theory of history. And it was always in the back of my mind, but I didn't pursue it until I came across a book written by Swami Sri Yukteswar in 1894. And he's an Indian sage, a Vedic Sanskrit scholar. And in there, he talks about these cycles of history, which the Indians call yugas, or the yuga cycle. And they're very specific about how we go from the lowest cycle, the Kali Yuga, then to the Dwapara, the Treta and Satya Yuga, which would be equivalent to the Greek ages of the Iron, Bronze, Silver, and Golden Ages. And then how we then go back again. And in there, he's got just one little line about that the ages are indirectly the result of our solar system's motion through space. And so when I read that, it took me on about a 10-year journey to really investigate if it could be possible. Is there any science behind it at all, or is it just a wish? And so that's basically what we've been doing at the Binary Research Institute, is investigating the cycle, the everything we could get our hands on about these different ages, the quality of the ages, and I've pretty much come to the conclusion that this idea of a great year, that was Plato's term for the cycle, which over 30 ancient cultures spoke about in their myth and folklore and passed down stories, does seem to have a basis in fact. I think that it's real.
So, Walter, you're saying that this shows up in ancient Indian writings, this shows up in ancient Greek writings. Does it show up worldwide in ancient writings?
Yes, and I don't think it's always as clear as you find it in the Indian and Greek writings. You know, Hesiod, the Greek historian poet, wrote beautifully about the quality of the higher ages, and the Indians go into great depth on the different characteristics of each age. But there are hints of it. You know, even in the Bible, the book of Daniel makes reference to this this dream of Nebuchadnezzar's, which is talking about the great year. The great year in mythology is often symbolized as this iron, bronze, silver, and golden something. And the book of Daniel talks about those metals in that order, and then it goes
so
in reverse order.
How long is the great year? I mean, I know, but for the audience, how long? Tell us about the duration of it.
Yeah, it's one precession of the equinox, which is presently calculated at about 25,665 years or so. But that is shrinking as each year goes by, the cycle length, because the rate of precession is increasing up. And then and we can get into that later, but according to the ancients, it will average 24,000 years. 12,000 years where we're in an ascending phase, where the geography and the environment of the Earth is more conducive to higher forms of thought, and 12,000 years in a descending age, where things seemingly go backwards. And therefore, our present system of time, 24 hours with 12 hours of AM and 12 hours of PM, which we can trace as far back as the Egyptians and Mesopotamians, that's about it, is a little microcosm of this cycle of the great year, 24,000 years.
Now, Walter, is this something that we could say is a scientific study? Is it just the fact that we've got this in the ancient writings, or do the monuments worldwide, especially some of the underwater monuments, such as off the coast of Japan, do these also correlate with the great year and with the ancient writings, thus making it a scientific study that we can see with our own eyes today?
Well, yes, if the great year is real, then one should find evidence of higher cultures in the past, before the Dark Ages. And the pit of the Dark Ages, which the great year scholars talk about, and it's interesting that even the classical scholars kind of agree, occurs around 500 A.D., about 1,500 years ago. So this is when most of the ancient civilizations had fallen. You know, even Greece and Rome are in ruins, and we're just in the depths of the Dark Ages, and we wallow there for, you know, about another 1,000 years before you have the Renaissance, which is the French word means rebirth, rebirth of the cycle. And so that's the low point.
Okay, so when I see the Sphinx, for example. Well, let me use a different example. Let me use, just the one everybody knows, the Great Pyramids in Egypt, which, to my knowledge, in our known technology today, nobody knows how to build. That's why you don't turn on the Discovery Channel and they don't have a show. It's called How They Built the Pyramids, because they only can come up with really wild theories that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of men would pull up blocks on a ramp or something, which is, you know, these blocks that weigh, you know, 100 tons sometimes, and it's really difficult to see how men could pull these. So with the pyramids, for example, in Egypt, are these better examples, such as Tiwanaku in Mesopotamia, or Baalbek is one of my favorite examples. Would you call these evidence of a past race of humans or something, where something on planet Earth was going on that was more advanced than is going on today?
Well, there was definitely something going on in that megalithic era, which is roughly, 5,000 years ago. 3,000 BC or so is probably you're in the heart of it, maybe 2,500 BC, 2,000 BC, and then it's starting to fade out. We're not 100% certain on all this dating. But they did find actually a pretty good one in Caral, Peru, where the pyramids, they didn't have the big, huge stones like they have in Egypt, so they cobbled together different stones and they put them in a basket, and this basket is made of a vine that just lives for a year. And so when these baskets were put into place, the vines were hermetically sealed. And therefore, we have very good dating on this carbon material, that this carbon material got in there in between the stones of the pyramid when they were built. And that dates to about 4,700 years ago. This is carbon dating from the University of Chicago. So it just kind of blew the socks off people that had, you know, been studying South America and all our beliefs about the age of the cultures there. And it puts it close to contemporaneous with the ancient Egyptian buildings.
Yeah, and there's a lot of correlations with how they, with a lot of their buildings.
That is evidence of something going on. Why they're doing it, you know, there's a whole bunch of different theories there. One, you know, we can only understand what we can relate to now, but one that I really like is is by John Burke. He's a scientist out of New York. We've had him at a few of our conferences on precession and ancient knowledge. And he's visited over 80 different megalithic sites, pyramids, Stonehenge, Avebury, etc., where he's taken readings. And he uses ground electrodes, electrostatic voltmeters, and magnetometers. And he's found that there is something going on there where there will be a little charge that's emitted from the structures that will effectively stress the seed. And they can do this in laboratories mm-hmm. today. People like Monsanto can, you know, just stress a seed a little bit with a little charge, and then that seed will propagate a little, you know, a little faster.
Mm-hmm.
And so it turns out there's some old myth and folklore about, you know, taking the seeds to the top of the pyramid to be blessed. Well, John found, sure enough, if you leave them there for about 24 hours so they get a full solar cycle, you know, as this Earth spins, this thing comes by the and gets a little kick from the sun. And so if they're built over a geophysical discontinuity, you know, like a river difference in plates or something like that,
mm-hmm.
it does produce this slight charge. And so that's just, you know, a pinch of evidence that we barely understand, that it can have a very practical effect to help agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they may well have had different purposes, too, because John's picked up some very interesting readings at, say, Avebury that we don't even know how to explain. He doesn't know how to explain.
Is John the one who wrote Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, have
okay,
you had
yeah.
him on your show?
No, I've got that book. I've been reading it. It's an incredible book.
Yeah, good hard science, too. He's not a mm-hmm. woo-woo guy.
Yeah, isn't it amazing, Walter, how the academics just, they're not interested in any of this stuff. The academics, and you don't have to, you can agree with me if you want, but I hold that they're basically, you know, 90% of their work is exploring theories, and I mean, they won't, you know, pick up their, get some plane tickets and get their shoes on and pick up a shovel and go over and look at the, you know, bail back over in Lebanon, which has, you know, 800 ton blocks and say, you know, and try to find out what's going on with that. And, you know, we can't build something like that today. And it's pretty interesting that they won't, they're just not interested, I guess. I mean, part of it, I mean, a little harsh. I mean, part of it is they're controlled by where the money's coming from, but it's a pretty amazing scenario.
Yeah. Well, in partial defense there, a lot of academics are great people, but they're just sticking to the hard science, and that's nothing wrong with that. That's a good baseline, how to figure things out. But you're right. Some of these mysteries that are very difficult to understand, we do need to maybe think out of the box a little bit. And there are some academics, you know, like Robert Schock
mm-hmm.
from Boston University. He's a tenured professor there, good guy. And he's, you know, as a geologist, he's looked at the Sphinx, and he's turning back the dating on it. So
can I ask you about that a minute? Now, as far as I know, just we've talked about that on the show briefly. Let me give a 5-second explanation. The Sphinx has evidence of significant water damage from rain. So the last time there was that much water that could do that kind of damage was, you know, back into 8-10,000 BC. So then you would have had to have had thousands of years of damage, of rain before that to make that kind of damage. So the Sphinx, then, we're looking at possibly 15,000 or more years BC for its creation. Well, how does that, do you agree with that theory, and how does that fit into the Great Year?
Schock wouldn't go quite that far back. He would say that it's probably at least several thousand years older than believed, and what they present believe is that it was contemporary with the Great Pyramid, the Khufu's era, or thereabouts, which is about, you know, 45 to 4,700 years ago, something like that. And, depending on who you talk to. And then, so he says, you know, maybe it's a few thousand years older. It could well be 5 or 10,000 years older, because the farther back you go, definitely the wetter that place is, which most mm-hmm. climatologists agree to. So that is definitely one idea, and I think it's pretty good science, and I've actually went to the U.S. Geological meeting just to hear Schock speak, and there were about 100 geologists in the room, and, you know, about 98 of them all seemed to pretty much concur with his science, and a couple questions,
right.
a few points, but he was in the majority for sure. There are other theories, one by Robert Temple, the author of, you know, Serious Mystery, and he just published a book, Mystery of the Sphinx, and he thinks it might be a little bit older, but not that much older, and that it once sat in a moat of water. And you know, you do see the Sphinx in a pit right now. And so we're going to have him at the conference this year and have him go through that whole theory so we can better understand that.
Yeah, before we go any further, could you tell us about the CPAC conference a little bit?
Sure, yeah. CPAC stands for Conference, Procession, and Ancient Knowledge. This is our sixth annual conference. It's held at the National Academy of Sciences Beckman Center on the UCI campus at the University of California, Irvine. And we'll have 8 to 10 speakers there. I think we're at 9 listed on the site right now. And then the public is invited to listen in as we talk about some of these ideas that are pushing back the clock of, you know, of civilization and really looking at ancient civilizations in a new way. So anybody that wants more information can just go to cpaconline.com. That's cpaconline.com.
Okay, great. Let's get into Lost Star. I've got many questions about it. Let's address this. You in the book say, let's say you suggest in the book that civilization could be enormously older than we believe it is due to the fact that if the ancients gained knowledge about the great year by mapping it, and for example, they weren't given the information by a more advanced race or something like that, we can get into that theory in a little while. If they gained that information by mapping it, that means that you would have had to have gone through several cycles before the map made sense. So we're looking at culture, if that's the case, going, you know, high civilization going back to 100,000 BC or something. What do you say about that?
Yeah, well, that's consistent with what the Greeks themselves tell us, that and I mention them in the book, there's 4 or 5 of the ancient Greek historians, you know, because we don't believe their history, we call them poets, but they will generally quote closer to 200 to 400,000 years ago. And it's also consistent with what some of the Indian scholars talk about, and some of them go even farther, that you have these cycles that repeat over and over and over again. Of course, you know, nothing really lasts more than a few thousand years, and even those structures are built out of, you know, very, very thick stone. And so unless something is carefully preserved, you won't have too much structural evidence. But I think we maybe err a little bit, Jeff, in always looking for structures or technologies, gizmos and gadgets, as evidence that there was once a higher culture. You know, if they don't have laptops and iPhones, then they must not have been a higher culture, is sort of our mindset.
Right.
And the whole, if you read about these higher ages, it couldn't be, you know, more different than it is now, in that they're recognizing that all the stuff we need is available in the natural world around us, and they're yogis. They've attuned themselves to nature, and they know how to, you know, pick up the vibrations of trees and memories from stones and things like this. And so if those sort of tales are true, that, you know, this mythology of the sort of pre-Babel era, then we're not going to find tons of technology. You know, we're going to find a very beautiful natural world.
Mm-hmm. So the Greeks then were part of a descending cycle. So then we find that's where writing kicked in, and that's where the philosophy of materialism, such as the philosopher Democritus. We get a lot of these more familiar philosophies and technologies, and such as writing, emerging on the descending cycle. So, is our society then on still in a descending cycle, or sorry, this more descended cycle? And do you think that we're at the doorstep towards making a big shift upward since we're in an ascending cycle now?
Well, I think, you know, I agree with scholars, you know, whether they're mainstream or not, generally agree around 500 AD is the pit of the Dark Ages. Virtually every ancient civilization is gone by then, and the Renaissance hasn't started. We're really not on the way up. So the last 1,500 years, we have definitely been on the way up, and you know, and we're new at these things, and we're going through very simple material progressions before we get into, you know, a knowledge of finer forces, finally discovery of electricity, magnetism, atomic energy, et cetera, just in the last few hundred years. And we're barely begun, you know, on this 12,000-year upcycle. But speaking of writing for just a sec, Jeff, I like this this story about Babel, and we find little bits of it in the Bible and, you know, some references and some other ancient myth, that pre-Babel was a time when mankind communed with the earth. He spoke with one tongue, according to you know, the Bible, and he, which is just, you know, the Bible to me is just the best efforts to save some of these stories. Yeah. And the and it's about the time then that man is building these structures, sort of the, you know, the megalithic era, the ziggurats, that sort of thing. The tongues are becoming confused. And I think the way the Bible puts it is, you know, because he built these structures, tongues, God confuses the tongues or something like that. And then, you know, you go farther, and that's about the time, you know, people start writing things down. Writing begins. And according to Paramahansa Yogananda, who wrote that very famous book, Autobiography of a Yogi, and he also talks about these cycles, he says that in the higher ages, in the Treta Yuga, which is the Silver Age, that telepathy and clairvoyance are common knowledge. So, and he says that was over around 3000 BC or so, and so we're losing it around that period of time, and then, you know, it's completely lost in the Dark Ages. And then he says by the year 4100 AD, when we go back into the Treta Yuga on our way up, telepathy and clairvoyance will once again become common knowledge.
So how far are we away from having these wonderful gifts in time? Is this a good couple thousand years away still?
Yeah, so yeah, 4100 AD, so that's, you know, almost 2100 years from now. And so, you know, that's not to say that some people that have really, there's always few people that are more advanced than the bulk of the population, and they seem to, you know, I'm sure some people are very gifted in that sense, but clearly, most of us are just dependent on telephones, laptops, writing,
yeah,
things like this to communicate.
Words, yeah. Let me sum up everything for the audience quick, and then I've got another question. So the basic idea here is that the religious texts, the ruins and monuments of the past, all point towards this grand cycle in history. Now, the key word there is cycle. It's a circular motion where we sort of repeat. We go from high, very sophisticated eras down into rather miserable Dark Age epochs, and then back again. And this repeats through history. This could have been happening for tens of thousands of years, at the least, this cycle. And it's extremely different from the what I would call the rather non-empirical history we've been given by many experts, this linear history, as you called it, where we're supposed to just believe that we came out of an ice age, in 9,000 BC or so. And before that, we really don't know anything about ourselves until we were monkeys 5 million years ago. So the Great Year is sort of a new vision of history, and it's, I would say, you can agree with me if you want or not, it's much more empirical, to say the least, than the history that we've been given by anthropologists and historians that are more in the traditional, you know, humans coming out of the Ice Age and all of a sudden building pyramids theory. Would you say that's a good summary of what we're talking about, or am I off in any way?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't belittle, you know, anthropologists or archaeologists at all. I think, you know, they're working under the present paradigm, you know, we're still very much in the low ages, so we tend to look at just material things, and we tend to look at things very linearly. Mainstream science doesn't recognize the cycle yet, and so they're kind of forced to look at things the way they do. And when you're trying to piece together something from, you know, little bits of evidence that are from thousands of years ago, you know, it's so difficult to do so. So
right.
I think we're kind of right exactly where you'd expect at this point in the cycle.
Mm-hmm. So is the philosophy of materialism, the idea that what exists is matter and our consciousness is physical, is this a low-age philosophy and viewpoint, or is it a high-age philosophy and viewpoint?
It's definitely a lower age. I go into great detail in this in the book, you know, what the Greeks say about it, what the ancient Hindus say about it, et cetera. But just a quick summary. So on the 12,000 years up, you have the, and let me use the Greek terms, they're the simplest, the iron, bronze, silver, and golden age. The another word for the iron age is the age of man. Another age for the bronze age, the next age up, is the age of the hero. Another word for the silver age, this is all the Greek terminology, is the age of the demigods. And another word for the golden age is age of the gods.
And so are we in an iron age right now, ascending iron age?
We're just on the threshold from the iron to the bronze, going from this gross age of man, material age, where we can only believe in what we can touch and feel and see, you know, with the five senses, to the beginning of the Bronze Age, the which the Indians call the electrical or the age of finer forces, and the Greeks call the age of the hero, where we can start to understand that the world is much more than what we see, and we start to change our views about things. There's a lot of paradigm shifts that are going on in this type of at this time when you're transitioning from the lowest age to the material age, where you think, you know, we're just these physical bodies and nothing more, to beginning to realize that, hey, maybe we're energy bodies or souls or something like that, and maybe there are finer forces that can help explain a lot of natural phenomena. We're at that threshold.
So you would say then that, let's take quantum mechanics, for example, which is quite convincingly shown us that the little tiny pieces of stuff that make up everything that we know of in the universe are little pieces of energy which don't have many, or if any, material qualities. So this was discovered and is influencing us and our philosophies worldwide now because we're in the ascending cycle, you would say.
Definitely. And that's what's going on. The age we're in colors the way we look at things. By the end of this age, instead of everybody thinking, I just exist in a material world and I'm just a hunk of flesh, pretty much everybody realizes this is all just a manifestation of energy, which is exactly what our quantum physicists are telling us right now, and I too am made of energy. And then, you know, the Silver Age, the age of magnetism, the age of also called the mental age in India, you start to realize that it's all mind stuff. And so, you know, it's almost impossible to comprehend ages above us because we're not there in consciousness yet. You know, a cup can't hold the ocean. But it's very easy to comprehend ages below us because, you know, we've been there, we can comprehend it, our minds are bigger than that, and it's so recent in our history.
Yeah, it's sort of like try telling someone in the dark ages about, you know, quantum physics or the internet or reality TV or something. It's going to be very difficult for them to understand any of it.
Oh, you're going to scare them. I sometimes use an analogy. If you could go back just a couple hundred years and talk to a farmer and, you know, tell them that there's going to be iPhones so that we can all talk to people in China and that we're going to clone farm animals and, you know, have rovers on Mars, he'd kind of say, well, why do you want to talk to people in China? Do you speak Chinese? And,
right.
And you know, why do you want to clone farm animals? Can't they reproduce anymore? He can't even relate to this stuff. It's impossible.
Now, Walter, I have all kinds of questions, but I want to make sure we get to what you think is most important first. Before I intervene here with 50 questions for you, do you have anything that you want to add? Anything at all?
Oh, I think we're on a pretty good roll, Jeff, but
okay.
There is just one little interjection here about the cause of the rise and fall of the ages, because that's, you know, what people always wonder. And mythology about this is kind of vague except for one thing. They always relate the ages to the movement of the stars, and particularly the precession of the equinox. If you look out at the stars on the equinox, they will slowly change, almost imperceptibly year to year, only 50 arc seconds. But if you look over, you know, thousands of years, you will see, you know, where the equinox, say the spring equinox, used to fall in Aries and it falls in Pisces, and now, you know, it's at the proverbial dawning of the age of Aquarius. That's not just some new age hippie statement. That's actually what you see if you look at the equinox in spring, that, you know, we're leaving Pisces and it's starting to come into Aries. And so they just use the stars as a marker of where the lower ages are and where the higher ages are. And so this great myth and folklore, and there's a wonderful book on this, it's called Hamlet's Mill by Giorgio de Santillana and Hertha von Deschen. And there's hundreds of myths in there, and you can see how they relate them all to the stars. And so much of our research, Jeff, has been focused on, you know, why bring the stars into this? And besides a marker, it turns out that, you know, the reason we see these different stars is presently hypothesized that the Earth wobbles. It's called the lunisolar theory of precession. But we think that it actually is better explained by the ancient reason, which is that the whole solar system moves. And either model can produce the same observable, with the stars seemingly moving across the sky at the rate of about, you know, 30 degrees every 2,000 years or so. And so it's just something to keep in mind as people think about this cycle, that it's indirectly due to our solar system's motion through space. As we go to a different environment, and, you know, different geography of the Earth in space, just as our environment affects us here on Earth, if we go to a different geography, and it can make it easier to grow things or harder to grow things, blah, blah, blah. Likewise, as we move in space, it can have this beneficial or negative influence on us. And
okay,
Excellent.
So these cycles are driven by what I'm just trying to outline this for the audience. They're driven by changes in consciousness. Now, what is it specifically that you discuss in the book that is responsible for changing our consciousness to these horrible periods where we're so ignorant compared to the high periods? In the Dark Ages, we were very violent and I guess I would say unhappy, for lack of a better way to put it. And then in the high periods, we're so spiritually advanced that we don't even really need to use words and language, at least spoken. We use telepathy and so forth to communicate. What is it that's causing these changes in consciousness globally?
Well, the myth and folklore is really vague on this, but there's a little bit that says it has to do with light, in essence. And so I guess think of it this way. As the Earth spins on its axis every day and we, you know, we begin to face the sun, we receive the, you know, the electromagnetic spectrum of the sun. It interacts with us, and our bodies are adapted to perform better when we're in the light, so to speak. And, you know, that's when we're in waking consciousness. And our bodies are adapted that when we're on the other side of the earth, away from the sun, they slowly go into a subconscious state. So it really does affect consciousness, although we usually don't think about it, that it has to do with the rotation of the earth and the amount of light that's affecting us. And the same thing works, too, Jeff, on the annual level, the annual cycle. The earth at a slight tilt goes around the sun. And when we're tilting towards the sun and getting more light per square inch in our hemisphere, what happens? You know, things suddenly spring out of the ground, grow, give their fruit, and billions of things start migrating, spawning, and all sorts of activity takes place. And then as we keep moving and there's less light, things begin, they start migrating backwards, they hibernate, they shut down, the plants literally die. You know, it affects trillions and trillions of life forms, this cycle, and just the waxing and waning of light. Therefore, okay, if our whole solar system is going, moving through space, coming closer to and farther from another stellar source, you would have the same effect going on. There would be a change in light. And you know, if you give two people a task to do, you know, building something out of Legos or whatever you want, and, you know, you give one person light and the other person doesn't have light, it is just easier to get it done in the light. Now, that's physical light. That at this low age, we think of light as, gee, only something you can see. But if you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, visible light is just, it's not even 1% of the spectrum. You know, the spectrum includes gamma rays and x-rays and, you know, ultraviolet to infrared, And that's these other things that are impacting us, affecting us in some way that we still don't completely understand. And I think that is what indirectly causes the rise and fall of consciousness over long periods of time.
So I want to ask two questions at once here. I want you to tell us about Valerie Hunt's work and how that plays into the great year. And also, with what you just said, are you specifically saying that when the other star in our binary system draws closer, the greater influx of light into our bodies and therefore into our culture as a whole elevates our consciousness?
Yeah, let me take Valerie Hunt's piece first, okay?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. That is a good, so go ahead.
Yeah. So Valerie Hunt was this, pretty well-known, professor at UCLA in, studying physiology primarily. And when microwaves first came along and, she was trying to understand, the effect of, you know, these subtle, energies on our bodies, you know, are they good, are they bad, how do they affect performance, that sort of thing. And so she took a number of subjects and put them in a room, which is called a Faraday cage, and those people involved in electronics assembly will know this, that it's designed, it's made out of metal and designed so it can eliminate a lot of the waves that are running through the atmosphere right now. You know, right now there's TV waves, radio waves, and everything going through us, plus all the natural waves.
Magnetic field.
From the sun, you know, and even more, which takes a while to get into. But anyway, she found that when she put subjects in there and gave them a test to do, she was just looking to see how they performed on the test. But the results that came back were that when people were isolated for, more than an hour or two from sort of the Earth's natural environment in this cage, they became very uneasy, very edgy. Some of them just cried. They just wept. But they didn't know why they were weeping. Why is their body reacting this way? Why is their, you know, their nature reacting this way? And so it appears that we need whatever's going on, the natural electromagnetic field of the sun interacting with the, you know, natural electromagnetic field of the Earth. We need to be attached to it. And when we get too far apart from it, it begins to hurt us. And NASA recognized this when they sent, you know, the first astronauts into space, that, hey, people are getting depressed up there. And there is a way that you can reverse the effect. And Valerie Hunt noticed this by, you know, negative ion can be used to enrich the atmosphere and make people feel good again.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, they do similar things now for our astronauts in space. And heck, most of the air filters sold in Japan have these negative ion generators in them, because it's something that's generated naturally by waterfalls and near the ocean and stuff like this. It just makes people feel good.
Mm-hmm. So what we're saying here is that certain kinds of electromagnetic radiation help our well-being. They can, let's say, spiritualize us. They make us more spiritual. And the lack of them will make us fall into lower levels of intelligence, into depression and so forth. Now, one thing I want to say here is I've been reading, actually because of reading Lost Star a year and a half ago or wherever when I first read it, I've become extremely interested in magnetic therapy and have started my own a little daily practice of magnetic therapy, and I sleep with a magnetic pillow. Excuse me. And I've noticed it's helped my – I meditate daily. I'm a Buddhist, and I've noticed that it's helped my meditation routine rather dramatically. It was going well before, but it's dramatically helped it. And also, there's been other sort of aids to my life that it's brought about. And I know that from reading about magnetic therapy, in general, a lot of people, a lot of experts in that field assert that AC currents are harmful to the body, and then the DC current, which is what the Earth operates on, is sort of a tonic for the body. And the stronger, well, I mean, if you strengthen it a little bit compared to what the Earth is just offering now, say up to a couple thousand gauss onto the various points, you know, say per square inch to the body, it greatly increases your health. It greatly increases your intelligence. The experts in magnetic therapy say it cures and eliminates the possibility of cancer and really almost any other kind of disease, unless you're doing something extremely harmful, like smoking, for example, to provoke cancer.
Yeah, we just kind of use it, Jeff, as this is a growth hypothesis, that
mm-hmm.
there's something going on with the electromagnetic spectrum of the sun and stars. I mean, all stellar sources are huge emitters of spectrum,
mm-hmm.
and the Earth, and you know, when it's in its most natural state, it seems to be most beneficial. And but we haven't really taken it any deeper than that. I don't know how it works. We have looked at things like, you know, transcranial magnetic stimulation (TMS) and. It's
interesting. Dr. Persinger's.
Yeah, not so much his, but I was looking at the anti-depression work that's been done clinically,
right.
And it really works, you know. Some people that have severe cases of depression, you can give them a treatment with this, and it seems to work for anywhere for 3 to 6 months, and then they need another treatment. I don't think anybody really knows why, but there is some clinical evidence that it's helping, and supposedly, you know, the magnetic age is the next age, so I'm not sure that we'll completely unravel it. And you know, when we think of magnetism now, we think of, you know, sort of a material, physical magnets and that sort of thing. And I just get the sense when I hear, you know, some of the monks talk about this sort of thing, that they're talking more about a human magnetism or a spiritual magnetism, that that's what we call it now. But there's some sort of higher magnetism that is difficult to understand.
Yeah, sort of like as if through the process of meditation we generate magnetism in ourselves, or it comes from some natural phenomena outside of us in a stronger way than now.
How about and our bodies wouldn't attract metal any easier. So we use the word magnetism, but it's really a higher form of magnetism. It's something
mm-hmm.
different.
Mm-hmm. Good, that's good clarification. How about the idea of two, I mean, it's a two-part question, pole shifts and 2012. What does that have to do? I mean, these are on a lot of people's minds. It's the pole shift concept is even making the mainstream media these days, because the Earth's magnetic field, to my knowledge, is decreasing rather quickly, and there's even big holes in it in places. Of course, that makes a lot of people think that there's a pole shift coming, and if that happens, then a lot of people start saying, oh, wow, the Mayan shaman kings were correct in their prediction about 2012. This is a huge topic, and I'm skimming it over quickly. A lot of listeners of this show are pretty familiar with it. What do you think about that? Is there any credibility to this, and how does it fit into the great year?
Most of my work has been focused on the great year, this platonic cycle, this, you know, rise and fall of the ages. And so that would say it's a fairly gradual effect that's taking place. That's not to say you don't reach certain points in the cycle where so many things become obvious, and yet all your institutions were formed hundreds of years ago, and so you kind of have to break those down to have new ones to, and so you probably have, you know, shifts going on from here and there that are fairly significant. But the only way that the work I've actually done on studying these polar movements is in relation to precession, Chandler wobble, things like this. And it looks like that there's really several different motions that people talk about. Number one is the magnetic pole is always moving. It's moved about 30 kilometers in the last year or so. The actual geophysical place where that pole is centered on our Earth, you know, and it's moved from Canada to Greenland to Russia and Alaska, et cetera. It sort of goes around there, and that's not a big deal that would shift just a little bit. Nobody knows why that happens. Then you have another type of pole, of course, which is the spin axis of the Earth, and that, as you know, generally now points to pretty close to Polaris, the star Polaris, and that that is supposed to move a little bit due to precession, and it's either due to lunisolar forces actually wobbling the Earth, or it's actually due to the whole solar system moving. But whatever causes it, it seems that the axis changes orientation. But that cycle is very slow. That's about, again, this 24,000 years, roughly. And then there's some that talk about, you know, an entire shift of the crust on top of the pole, and this is the Hapgood sort of theory where the skin moves like skin of an orange over the surface of the orange. And I don't think there's too much evidence of that, because if you look at, island chains, archipelagos, I'm over in Maui right now, and, you know, you look at how the Earth has been shifting over this hot spot that causes all these islands, it's been very gradual, a very nice arc. You see the same thing in the Aleutians and other places.
Mm-hmm.
It's that's been pretty stable for millions of years. And then,
yeah.
Of course, there's a flip of the magnetic pole, which happens every 600,000-700,000 years. You find it in the geology of the Earth. And that's interesting, and I guess we supposedly are due for one of those, and I wonder what that would actually cause in outward effects, you know, as birds, would they migrate differently, and what
yeah, the
would
rotation
really
of
happen
the planet.
There? Yeah. So that, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I want to know what's all this 2012 magnetic field, you know, all these, this basket of topics that are sort of we're discussing here at once, but I'm with you. I don't really have a lot of conclusions to make about it. I'm sort of waiting to see what happens in 2012, if anything. But it is interesting.
Yeah, you know, we always have these things where people are saying the world's coming to an end, and it's throughout history, and that major changes are coming. And yeah, there's changes happening all the time, and certainly we're overdue for some changes, you know, as our older institutions sort of fall away and newer ones replace them. But I just really don't have much more to say on the whole subject than that, other than I'm hopeful about the future. It seems like we really are in an ascending age. People are getting smarter and more aware, and hopefully we can all work together and create a better world.
Yeah, it's exactly what I think. I think we're in for a future renaissance. There's a lot to worry about right now. We've got a lot of economic problems, and I think there's sort of a food crisis with the genetically modified food. And there's a lot of things you could talk about, but it does seem like we're in for a human renaissance. And based on what your book is talking about, and we may, in 500 years or so, think that the problems that we have now weren't really problems because they were so easily solvable, because we could be that much more intelligent. It's just, you say in your book that the people in one age can't understand, you know, in the Bronze Age, for example, can't understand so well people in the Iron. I really, really like that idea because, in my own mind, the way I look at the world, I just feel that, humans have this huge brain and this incredible mind, and we're not using it to our capacity right now. That I'm not saying, you know, the old cliche where people say, oh, you just use 10% of your brain and so forth. I'm just saying this organ that we have in our skull and this nervous system we have connected to it is the most complex entity that I know of in the universe. And it seems that we're just acting like a bunch of silly people on planet Earth right now in a lot of ways with our wars and so forth. It seems like there's a lot more that we're capable of. So it's almost like that's evidence for the idea that humans are much more than we currently believe ourselves to be, and the past ages and the future ages will verify that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, speaking of you know, how much brain power you use, there are a couple of markers for the different ages, and some of the Indian teachers do talk about you use very little of your brain capacity in the lower ages, and then it increases 25, 50, 75, until you're using the full amount in the higher ages. They also relate it to age. So in the lowest age, you know, people rarely live to be 100 years old. And in the next highest age, by the end of this Dwapara, people living close to 200 will be more commonplace. And then in the next one, 300, and then the next one, 400 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have all these records, very ancient records, around the world, the Pharaonic, dynastic lists, which show that the ancient pharaohs lived these very long lifetimes, and it's fairly linear. The farther back you go, the longer they seem to live. And we have the stories in the Bible about Seth and Methuselah and people living a very long time, Noah. And, same thing, the Chinese dynastic records, you know, way, way back in time, the earliest ones, very long dynasties. They get shorter and shorter as you go towards the Dark Ages. And, of course, you know, since the Dark Ages, lifespans are increasing again. And so it does. It's interesting how you can find these correlations to, you know, our brain power, our age, the way we view things that, that tie in with the changing ages.
Now, Walter, obviously this discussion makes us sort of think that a lot of what we've read about in the ancient religions is a little more literal than some people want to. It's very trendy now. For example, the church my wife and I go to, it's very trendy to say the Bible is basically, most of it is just symbolism and so forth. So, you know, your book and a lot of the ancient ruins around the world and so forth, and what you're just discussing with the increase in ages, all make it appear that these books are, in a lot of ways, just history books that a lot of people don't understand at all right now. So now that leads me to a question. In these religious books worldwide, which I often hold, more or less tell the same story in different words with some variations, but there's accounts of underworlds and dragons and creatures in the sky and ancient astronauts and sort of star beings from other worlds that came and created humans. What is your position on some of these more, what people would call more fantastical notions of the world religions now? Are these also issues in the world religions we should take seriously, or what are your feelings about this?
Boy, there's a whole study there, you know, in what's true and not true in ancient myth and folklore. Again, I really love this book, Hamlet's Mill, because it looked at so many different myths, and then they would trace the same myth from different country to country, and sometimes different countries would put a different spin on it, and you could get a little different feeling for it. But, I think that ancient man was very, very intelligent. He lived in tune with nature. He could do things that we can't imagine. And so in the darker ages, they would refer to that as, you know, magic and things like this. And whereas I think in the higher ages, we can, you know, it might seem magical to us now, but we'll discover the underlying principles of, you know, physics or metaphysics, whatever it is, you know, that things have reasons. There's an interesting story somebody recently sent me. He's a professor, and he teaches the yugas at Ananda University in Northern California. Mm-hmm. And David Steinmetz. And they recently took a trip to Egypt, and they were studying, I think it was Ramses II or Ramses III, which happens to be, in terms of the yuga cycle, right about where we are now. So we're 1,500 years ascended mm-hmm. from the Dark Ages, and this was about 1,500 years before the Pit of the Dark Ages. But, of course, they're coming down from a spiritual age and to a material age, and we're going up from a material age to a more spiritual age. At least that's the way some would interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have then a court case, and somebody has died. And just like they do now, they have a judge, and they call in witnesses. They're trying to find out, you know, who killed this person and whether they're guilty or not. And whereas now we can only admit material evidence, you know, physical things into evidence, back then they had a different type of evidence they could bring in. What they did was they actually called the deceased as a witness. And so he was somehow channeled, and he was able to point to who the murderer was, and that helped simplify the trial. So I just found that so interesting, and it sort of tells you the character of the ages, and how we can really not understand how things worked in a prior higher ages, because we've really lost touch with that level of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. So how about the idea, this is a more fun topic, it's sort of speculative but fun. In my meditation work, I've seen some things that have rather shocked me, and I'm reluctant to even discuss them with people I'm really close to that trust me, because I don't think anybody would believe it, but in some of the more productive times of my meditation work in the last 20 years, I've seen some things that remind me a lot of what people have written about in the religious texts. Now, is it possible that in the higher age our consciousness can see more than we see now? I mean, I look out my window here and I see beautiful sky and green trees and so houses and so forth. Is it possible that in a higher state of consciousness there's more to that picture that we could see, other coinciding worlds or spirit worlds or star creatures or something that all these world religions discuss, in which in the golden ages or the silver ages are accessible to our consciousness, which is higher at that point, which we don't see in the current age now?
Without a doubt. You know, you can see it as we come up from the depths of the darkest ages. We expand our capabilities, but when we're still in the material age, we do it through material means. And so we do it through telescopes. They help us see farther. Or through microscopes. They help us see smaller. And, you know, we use sort of mechanical ways to expand the senses, or, you know, ability to talk to somebody. You get microphones, and then, you know, telephones with wires, and then wireless telephones, and soon you can talk to, you know, somebody around the world without any wires. And so all our capabilities are expanded, first in a material way, then in an energetic way, mm-hmm. and then in a mental way, and then in a spiritual way. Those are, you know, the four basic qualities of each of the ages. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you tell me how we do this energetically and mentally expand. I have a tough time relating to that, but maybe you're sort of tapping into it a little bit intuitively through some of your meditations.
Well, I'm pretty inspired by, I mean, there's this great cycle going on, and I can just simply see it. I mean, when I read your book, it just was absolutely, you know how everybody's got five or ten books they've read that just absolutely shattered their paradigms and changed the way they see things. Your book was one of mine. You know, another one that I've talked about is Henry David Thoreau's Walden, for example. But I've read that one several times. But it's interesting in this cycle, we find people such as Jesus, such as maybe Joan of Arc, or people that do seem to be higher than what the age they're in is as if they're living. They're just an exception that's living in age. You know, as if their consciousness is in a higher age than the rest of the people. Now, it makes me think that all of us could do things. Maybe there are technologies or spiritual technologies out there, or in some way we could figure out how to elevate our consciousness in the way that they are in a silver or golden age. And I've been very curious of that. Of course, like you say in your book, meditation is possibly a higher age technology, and that's how I've started to refer to it in the same way on my radio show and in writings and so forth, as a high age technology. And it's as if this is something that's inside all of us. It's a sort of a cliched statement, but I do believe this, that it's that, you know, when you smoke DMT, for example. I never have. I'd like to, but I've never been able to get my hands on any of the great psychedelic that the shamans of the Amazon take part in. They say as soon as they have the psychedelic inside them, they're in contact with some higher intelligence, perhaps even the creative intelligence behind everything. And it's interesting that this plant does that to them. And what's more critical, DMT is in all sorts of plants, and it's naturally in our consciousness. And we don't really put too much into ourselves when we smoke DMT. It's as if we're mostly just catalyzing what's already in ourselves. So I do live by the idea that we could create, if we could figure this all out, we could create a golden and silver age perpetually for ourselves, which would be, when you hear about the horrors of the Dark Age, and when I look at, you know, our current wars that we're engaged in now worldwide, anything from Zaire to Iraq to Darfur, or, it's just really makes me long for humanity to become more of what it actually is. And we need to find these energies that are responsible for altering our consciousness, or maybe I should say bringing our consciousness to what it really is. Do you have any comment about that before I move on?
Well, sure. There's that's kind of in the back of the book of, you know, in Lost Star Myth of Time, I think chapters 8 and 9, we start to get into, you know, what were things really like in the higher ages? And it's, again, I'm trying to interpret it through little bits of myth and folklore and some of the deeply meditating monks and nuns that I know that, you know, seem to have some insights into these matters. And so, yes, meditation, you know, I'm trying to sort of understand the technology of it, but some of these advanced practices like Kriya Yoga, they actually interpret it or talk about it in terms of, you know, running the energy up and down the spine, awakening each of the chakras. They call it magnetizing the spine. And so it's just a sort of a Dwapara way we can look at a higher age technology, you know, by talking it in terms of energizing, magnetizing, things like this.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it's really tough to fully comprehend until you do it a lot and
mm-hmm.
sort of feel the benefits.
So now you
and,
don't. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
So you don't. So I've heard you. George Norrie asked you when you were on Coast to Coast AM if you, which that was a great show, by the way. All the listeners should go try to find that on the internet or something. Just look up, I think on YouTube, Walter Cruttenden, George Norrie, or Coast to Coast or something. And that was a fantastic show. But he asked you if you subscribe to an ancient astronaut theory, sort of the idea that humans are created by what I like to call star creatures, you know, advanced, but you could call them gods or, you know, sky travelers or aliens or whatever you want, but sort of something along the lines of a more advanced race that came to Earth and in some way or another created humans, whether by genetically modifying apes or, you know, sort of splicing their DNA, the star creature's DNA with apes to create, you know, us, which is a go-between, or, you know, a mediary sort of creature. And then they taught us, they gave us plants like hemp and taught us how to farm and taught us about the great year and so forth. Now, you have said on George Norrie's that you do not subscribe to that theory because we don't see these creatures anymore. I'm wondering if you just could comment on that, why you don't subscribe to that theory, if you think it's a theory that's just there's too little evidence or what you feel about it.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, there's interstellar influences that are occurring all the time. We can talk about that. You know, when we think of aliens and spaceships and stuff like that, it's just a real sort of material way to relate to other material things on some planet or something that might be really, 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 really far away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a feeling that the universe is even more complex and more beautiful, more unimaginable than we ever have imagined. And that, have you read Swedenborg's work by any chance?
What's the title?
You know, he wrote half a dozen books back in, I think it was 1700s, and he was sort of this mystic seer inventor.
Mm-hmm.
And when he talked about aliens, you know, he was often talking about, you know, angelic beings from other spheres, other realms that we couldn't see. He was talking about, you know, life forms on the sun, stuff like this that sounds completely ridiculous and impossible to material world consciousness today. And yet I think there might be a grain of truth in that if we don't limit life to some other biological form that has to get in a spaceship and come over here. You know,
right.
I, So that's sort of my thoughts on it.
Yeah, like you said early in the show in different words, we formulate things in how we see now, how we see them now. And I think you had on your radio show, by the way, all the listeners should listen to your, because you go to, I think it's BinaryResearchInstitute.com, listen to all your radio shows. They're some of the best radio I've ever heard, no exaggeration. You just had, I think his name's Gregory Samos on your show, and he discussed how, I actually bought his book after I heard that show, and I've been reading it. And all the ancients in general, I mean, Brahman was compared to an infinite sunlight, and Buddha was compared to an infinite sunlight, and the sun was often worshipped and called to be conscious. And we have, I mean, if we all look inside our own heads.
And throw Jesus in there, too. I mean, he said, ye are God. These things that I do, ye shall do also in greater things. And, you know, I'm not trying to espouse religion, but I think there's a really deep truth in that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's as if the religions are... as I said previously, describing more or less the same story and saying that this is what we're all capable of. And we have this way of thinking now in the world, which we call science. I don't use that word so much anymore. I use now empirical thought, because science has been so sort of taken over by big money and whatnot. But it's as if the religions are not understood in the scientific perspective. And, you know, in a book like Samos's book, where he's talking about an underlying consciousness, which we can't recognize. And if we look inside our own thoughts, we see something which we cannot put into words. Nobody can describe love. Nobody can describe a feeling or a thought. And, you know, if I look inside your brain, or if somebody looks inside mine, you find in the material perspective that we're in, we just find brain cells and so forth. So, I mean, that right there, this proof that we all can see with our own experience inside of us of our non-physical consciousness, just should really tell us all that there's something huge going on. I mean, the academics have not been able to really get their hands around consciousness and try to put it in good terms and describe it. And this is just good evidence that there's, like you just said, there's something absolutely huge about our whole cosmos. That in our current age, our current state of consciousness globally, we're having a difficult time understanding. When we get to this higher understanding, we wouldn't be able to communicate it to, you know, who we are now.
Right. So yeah. You know, you talk about religion, spiritual things. When we try to interpret these things at the lowest age, the material age, we put this material cloak on it. And it's probably the farthest thing from it. And,
right.
You know, we have no direct contact with God. You know, it's going to come through a priest who comes through a pope who comes through, you know, mm-hmm. some divine books. And it's really remote from the self versus, you know, you get into the higher ages, we begin to, you know, realize what we are. And we're so much deeper. And I think it gives us so... just a great, beautiful insight to what religion or spirituality is.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you something. Are you familiar with the work of Paul LaViolette? By any chance on the pulsars?
Yeah. I have studied some of his stuff.
Yeah, I find his work, I'm actually going to have him on the show here in the next couple weeks, because his work has absolutely shocked me as much as yours has. He basically, I won't recount all of his work now because we've talked about it on the show in detail in the past. But in general, 10-second summary, he's got a sort of pretty good evidence. I was going to say proof, but let's just say very good evidence that there are galactic civilizations in our solar system, and they all are sort of communicating information about energy waves that are pulsing out from the center of the galaxy. Now, what I want to ask you is it possible, as some authors nowadays are suggesting, that our elevation in consciousness and our descension in consciousness could be in part, you know, the great year, it could be in part caused by a totally different energy source than what we've talked about so far in the show, and it could be something, for example, of cycles in the energy from space, such as coming from the center of the galaxy? What are your thoughts on that?
you know, I've heard Paul talk about that, and Paul has some pretty good credentials, I think, as a physicist.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting to see him hypothesize that, and I do know that you know that all stars are emitters of, you know, electromagnetic spectrum and huge generators, and the, you know, the biggest mass of those in our anywhere near us, and it's really not very close, is the galactic center. It's almost 23,000 light years away. So it would be logical, I guess, that you'd have sort of more energy coming from there. And so that's kind of what Paul has said, that there are these bursts from time to time. Before about, I think 1997, it wasn't even believed that any star could affect us in any way.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And that was, it was that year a nurse was driving home from a Seattle hospital. She had the radio on, and she, you know, was suddenly switched to a North Dakota station or something like that. And that's, at the same time, ham radio operators went off the air and things like this. And some astrophysicists happened to notice, this is just like, you know, a solar flare event that affects radio communications here on Earth, but it's happening at night. And so he did some tracing and realized that, oh, there's some other stars that now and then they give off these huge, you know, gamma ray bursts, and they're actually, you know, affecting our ionosphere, our magnetosphere, and, you know, having real effects that we can sense here in our instruments here on Earth. And so from that point on, I think even mainstream science just recognizes, okay, stars have some effect on us. And it appears that Paul's work is sort of a follow-up to that, to try to explain some of the great year stuff. But I do lean a little bit more towards some of the Vedic interpretations, even though I don't understand it as much, that it's due to this motion of our solar system, you know, bringing a waxing and waning of light than it is sort of to any outburst from the galactic center.
Now, let me ask you this. The star that you theorize in your book Lost Star, Myth and Time, as being our binary partner is the star Sirius. Which...
Well, hold it. That's just if there's a visible companion. I spent two chapters going through the other scenarios, brown dwarf, black dwarf, you know, red dwarf, black hole, all that sort of thing also.
Yeah, the reason I bring Sirius up is because a lot of listeners of this show are going to instantly, as soon as they hear about Sirius, they're going to instantly think, you know, there's the Dogon and the Egyptians. All these ancient cultures are absolutely obsessed with Sirius in various ways. And then we also know that there's something strange. There's that, what's the name of that book? Here it is right here on my shelf, Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital by David Ovesen, published by Perennial. On page, it's just in the first couple pages, page 4 and 5, he discusses how our nation's capital, known to very few people, is actually outlined in the hieroglyph of what the picture that the Egyptians used to describe the star Sirius, the Sirius star system. So there's all kinds of these indications worldwide, past and present, of people in power positions or ancient cultures being absolutely concerned with the star Sirius. How does any of this play into the possibility that Sirius is our binary system, and why would it have be of such interest to ancient cultures and even perhaps whoever the designers of the nation's capital were?
Right. Well, there's all sorts of pros and cons to Sirius being, you know, a companion to our sun. And most astronomers, astrophysicists would just instantly dismiss it because Sirius is, you know, a little over 8 light years away, presumably, and that it's just way too far away for our solar system to get around in 24,000 years, one precession cycle, and therefore it's pretty easily dismissed from sort of.
But then you discuss in your book how the solar system appears moving much, much faster than people previously thought. So therefore, Sirius is pretty. It could be a feasible scenario.
Right. Yeah. On the positive side, the work from Reg Cahill, astrophysicist down in Australia, says that the solar system is moving much, much faster than people think it is. And it's hard to measure because you say relative to what? And, you know, if you're measuring to some star, well, how fast is that the star's moving and do we really know, you know? And so, but he measures against the cosmic microwave background, the CMB. And there's pros and cons to that, but you're right. He absolutely nails exactly the speed that we need to get around Sirius and back. And so he's got some interesting papers on that, and I would encourage mainstream scientists to look at that. Another thing is that Sirius seems to move with the sun in spite of precession. And there's a lot of articles on this. There's one recently by Jed Buchwald, who's a professor, astronomer at Caltech, professor of the history of science there. And he talks about these ancient records of Sirius. So it just keeps about its same distance to the sun, its markers, solstice, equinox, that sort of thing, which is very unexpected, you know, because stars are thought to all separate themselves due to precession.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the, you know, some people dismiss that, oh, it's just the way Sirius sets in the sky. But I'm not 100% sure. Fourier, the great mathematician, thought there was really something to it, although B.O. Ignored it. There's the Homans out of Canada. And they've done some interesting transit work with telescope aimed exactly at Sirius, and it's a fixed telescope. You know, it's sandbagged at the bottom. It's bolted in. It just points at Sirius, and then, you know, so they see it once a day in the crosshairs as the Earth spins and gets back to that point. And they've been running this experiment for over 20 years. They find no precession in relation to the star Sirius. And, you know, no other scientists can believe their data. I went up to Canada. I met them. I checked out their stuff. And they have fabulous records. They have a radio tuned to the atomic clock at Fort Collins. They actually keep it in the ground to keep the crystals cold. These measurements, transit measurements, average out over time. It looks a lot like Sirius could be our companion because it would be the one star that moves with the sun and does not precess. Because, you know, precession.
Now, tell us about, there's evidence apparently that, was it called Gravity Probe B or something? We sent up a probe, maybe you could tell us about this, how we discovered some unexpected precession, and does that precession point towards Sirius being the companion or some other companion, or is it too hard to tell?
Gravity Probe B doesn't have anything to do with Sirius, but indirectly it's produced some data. So, you know, we've been thinking of ways we can have to look and see, does the Earth wobble or is it just the solar system movement that causes this apparent wobble, the stars moving backwards across the sky at the rate of 30 degrees per 2,000 years. And so we looked at the Gravity Probe B because it was this ideal experiment, you know, sent up there with a perfect gyro pointed at another star. It should be far above the wobbling Earth, should not have any precession in it whatsoever. And yet they got all these goofy readings, so much so that NASA gave Gravity Probe B an F. And I happen to think it might get an A, but they just found something that was completely unexpected, and that precession isn't caused by the wobbling Earth. It's caused by the whole motion of the solar system, not that torques the Earth's axis in any way, but as the solar system moves, it gives an apparent change of our axis relative to the fixed stars. And so, yeah, we're still trying to get the raw data there because they had some hints in their press releases that they were finding the precession effect. And I've been up to Stanford and I've met with them, and but it's going to take a while until they release that stuff.
That's interesting. How about some of the other theories, such as Andy Lloyd has what he calls the dark star theory, you know, the brown dwarf theory. Do you feel that these are better candidates or worse candidates, or is it too early to tell for what the companion is? Of course, a brown star, or sorry, brown dwarf is just a dense star that's not very bright, which is apparently just out of view right now. Now, of course, the Zechariah Sitchin crowd is really behind that theory. What are your? Can you tell us a little bit about the brown dwarf theory and how you feel about it compared to the Sirius theory?
Yeah, I lean towards the visible star theory, not just because of the experimental data we've seen and the historical records that it seems to move with the sun, but because so many ancient cultures point to it also. The Egyptians, you know, it said it brought life and took it away. I mean, it just sounds like that's the driver of the great year cycle.
Right.
They called it Isis and their thing. The Shinto in Japan, they align their temples to it, and they call it our second sun, period, you know, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's so much evidence like that. Also, if we were in a binary system in another stellar system, you know, a million light years away or something, we would just naturally look up and say, okay, if this is our sun, then the next brightest star would be our logical companion. And, you know, the brightest star in the sky for us is Sirius, and yet we dismiss it because we have this other theory that kind of gets in the way of even thinking
mm-hmm.
we might have a companion.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I go towards that, and the brown dwarf, you know, we had to look at all those possibilities, but our technology nowadays is such that if there's a brown dwarf there or even a black hole there, we would have detected something by now. And so I do lean towards the other way to go. As far as the whole Sitchin thing and Nibiru, it's very interesting. If you read the footnotes in Hamlet's Mill, you'll
mm-hmm.
find some very old references to Nibiru, which, you know, it goes back to Sumerian records. And
right.
they don't describe it exactly like Sitchin does. They do call it a crossing star, but they say that it is the brightest object in the sky. So that would either be, so some early scholars thought that it was maybe Jupiter that they were referring to because it's the brightest planet, or Sirius. And so there's a number of scholars that think Nibiru actually means Sirius. And if it would be a crossing star, that would exactly fit the companion scenario in it. It would be the one star that sort of seems to cross across the skies, as some Arabic records talk about. And
yeah, I agree with you on that. And in fact, I've shared that same opinion. And I'm a big fan of Sitchin, but I do agree that some of his discussion of Nibiru is a little bit quick, to put it that way. Now, here's a question I've been wanting to ask you for a long time. It's an off-the-wall question. Do you, now, in our culture, economically, we value gold and silver and, you know, metals like platinum and so forth, in bronze and iron in certain ways, and they correspond, it seems, in the same way that, you know, like the golden age is the highest age and gold is our most valued metal. And then after that is, say, silver. Is there any correlation to this, why we still in our current age? I mean, I for example, know people that are investing in gold, and, you know, it's just a practical investment. But it's just interesting that of all the amazing metals out there, that gold is the one that's still most valued. And then we call our highest ages golden ages. And then, of course, past cultures, such as the Mayans, were so interested in gold. Is there anything to any of these correlations?
I think there is, yeah. You know, why are certain metals and certain gems valuable? Why do we hold them so dear? And I think it goes back to myth and folklore and perhaps some higher age science that we've lost knowledge of. Sri Yukteswar talks about this in, I think it's an autobiography of a yogi, that certain gems and certain metals have subtle properties that can be beneficial to us. And so it might explain, you know, why, you know, in olden times a king would wear a crown of gold with certain gems implanted in it, and he'd put it on his head, and then he'd sit in a certain chair, you know, a throne facing a certain direction or something. You know, it's probably part of some ancient meditation technique or something. And many people, of course, today now wear bangles, and but Yukteswar says that the gem has to be worn next to the skin to have an effect.
And they interestingly often have magnetic properties. A lot of gems do.
Yeah. If you think that we're still in the lower ages and there's a lot we need to learn about subtle energies, and then at least we have to keep an open mind to that there's some truth there, but I sure don't understand it at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you, in all your study of past cultures, I know that you're a big fan of the Vedas, and you've recently talked about Stephen Knapp's research on your show, and that prompted me to actually buy a couple of his books, which I've not been able to get into much lately. What is your, of all the cultures you've studied, what's the one you're most impressed with and you're most inspired by?
Well, it probably is that, in that they're, the Indian culture, yeah, they have their more intact documents from long, long ago, apparently, than any other culture. You know, when people were going around trying to write down the myths before they were all gone in the late 1800s, early 1900s, they found that in, you know, certain places in Nordic countries, Finland, for example, they could find somebody on one side of the country that would recite their national myths there, and somebody on the other side could recite them also, word for word, and they'd never talk to each other, and they're reciting these myths that had never been written down. And same thing happened in India, but on a larger scale, where people in different parts of the country could recite these books word for word. And so because those books appear to date back to a very long time ago, we often use them to, you know, try to understand what the higher ages were like.
So what do you think about something like Stonehenge? What there's a lot of discussion of how it was the dimensions, like with the Great Pyramids in Egypt, were dimensions of the solar system. But if, when you think about Stonehenge, where does that fit in to the Great Year? And what exactly was its purpose, do you think?
I really don't know, other than to say that, you know, what I was taught when I was at school was that man was a hunter-gatherer 5,000 years ago, 6,000 years ago, and he could barely grow his crops. And so he needed a calendar to make sure he would plant them at the right time and harvest them at the right time. So what did he do? He went out and he got 50-ton-plus stones, dragged them together and built something aligned, you know, to the cardinal points so he could grow his crops better. And I think a few anthropologists have come along and said, well, maybe he had to be pretty well just to have the time to do that. So that's dismissed, and we really don't know. But I have been studying Avebury, which is, you know, not too much farther away, I think 30 miles or so. And it is an even larger circle, although not as impressive because it's, you know, some of the stones have been torn down. And that's where I think I mentioned my friend John Burke had gone, and he took a magnetometer to stones. You know how we were talking about pole shifts, where you can, how you tell how the magnetic poles are on the Earth by looking at old stones?
Right. Under, yep.
So he took a magnetometer and took over 1,000 readings of all the 66 remaining stones there. And he figured out where the positive pole and the negative pole is on each of those stones, you know, based on, because all stones have a positive side and a negative side, not just magnets. It's however they're grown by the Earth, you know, in relation to the North and South Pole. And you'd expect them to be all random, what he found was all the stones have their positive side facing the next stone in line in front of them and their negative side facing the last stone behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're aligned by polarity. And, Jeff, I don't know what that means, but it does tell us that this ancient culture was aware of subtle magnetic properties of stones that it takes us a magnetometer nowadays to figure out, and they were aligning them to similar to how we would create a particle accelerator, you know, like CERN nowadays, where we align magnets.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to say I don't think they were using it for particle acceleration, but it must have had some purpose for them to go to all that effort to put those very heavy stones in place and align them by polarity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are huge mysteries. Well, they're mysteries to us in our age or our level now, but you just think that in the higher ages, these were just as simple as riding a bike, whatever they were doing. That's my suspicion. They had some kind of natural abilities or technologies or something that were very basic. Them due to their higher level. I myself do not rule out the ancient travelers, the star travelers theories that there are civilizations that have come here to help us at certain times, and for some reason or another, we don't see them now. And it may not have been this material where they come in some clunkered UFO that's made out of metal or something. It could have been a technology or a method that we couldn't even put into words right now of how they came into contact with us to help us in the higher ages. And,
did you ever look at Ronald Mallett's work, professor at the University of Connecticut? Someone you might have on your radio show, because he's a professor that's talking about time travel, and he's building an experiment to observe time traveling on a very small scale, you know, just a neutron in a circulating light beam. And so he's kind of using Einstein's theory to, if you can bend light, you can cause something to travel through time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we talk about light, we tend to think of visible light, but as we mentioned earlier, there's many other things in the light spectrum, in the electromagnetic spectrum. It could well be, and this is just for fun, I throw this out, I lose all credibility with all mainstream scientists, but that these ancient circles were somehow a technology to do this. And
mm-hmm.
and there's even an old African myth where, you know, these stone circles, there's thousands of them all around the world. The African myth is that there's two people go to a circle. One goes into the circle and one stands outside. The one that goes into the circle disappears. And when the one outside, when he gets back, he talks to his friend on the outside, and the friend says, where were you? Where did you go? And he said, not where did I go, when did I go?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, as far as light goes, whoever and whatever the beings were that wrote down and influenced our ancient religions, they were absolutely concerned with light, and they did not hold it to be, you know, quantum moving as a wave and a particle, and that's about it. They held it to have some sort of special power connected to, if not identical to, God or the religious creative powers of the cosmos. I mean, when Paul was traveling, or they call him Saul in that part of the Bible, was traveling to the road to Damascus, he had his vision of God where he fell down because it was such a powerful vision. They called the vision light. So that and many other reasons would lead me to conclude that our current description of light that we have in our physics books and so forth is, you know, there's a lot that is going to be added to that in the coming centuries. And I think a lot of physicists really suspect the same thing. They're absolutely baffled by what they're finding when they do their research in quantum mechanics. And they sense that there's something huge and powerful that we're on the verge of discovering. And I think it's probably just, you know, the word research is a, you know, two words, research. We're doing a research. Our scientists are researching what has already been discovered, and what we're going to find is that light is this is somehow some divine force or something, to put it in poor words, since I don't have any better words to use. So I definitely agree with you that when you were describing how what's possibly behind the cycle of the great year is light in some way. But light, as we were both sort of agreeing, and not in a way we traditionally and typically understand.
Not just
visible
light,
culture.
The entire electromagnetic spectrum, yeah.
Yeah, right, right. This energy, which we call gamma or X-ray or whatever. There's something, since the ancients were so concerned with it, something pretty amazing to it that we're going to find out, and that perhaps people are finding out through meditation. Now, we're coming close to the end here. Is there anything else, Walter, that you want to add? You can plug any of your websites and your books and the conference or anything else you want to add. You've got the floor.
Yeah. A lot of people say, okay, so what? We're in this great cycle. Ages go up and down. You know, what does that have to do with me? And we had made a film on this topic. It's called The Great Year. It's narrated by James Earl Jones. You know, anybody can get it on Amazon. And we've had just some wonderful feedback from that film, including a letter I got, email from a school teacher who had seen it. And she was sort of halfway through the film, and she found herself crying. And she didn't know why she was crying. And then she realized, as a little girl, she had believed in this great cycle, a higher age, a beautiful earth with tremendous potential, and that she was much more than just a physical being. And she'd been told in school, stuff it, you know, forget those thoughts. There was no golden age. It's just a fairy tale. And when she realized that there's a scientific reason for a rise and fall of the ages, and that a lot of this myth and folklore about a long-lost higher age may be true, it was just a cathartic release for her.
Mm-hmm.
Her intuition as a human being, a little girl believing in a magnificent history, was okay. You know, she wasn't stupid. She wasn't deranged or anything. And I think when we remember, that's two words, are and member, when we remember our past, we can really begin to build a more beautiful future.
Yeah, that's exactly what I also assert. Now, give us some of your websites where we can find out more information about you and your research.
Sure. Our main research website is the Binary Research Institute, and that we post things about the solar system and the sort of mechanics of this cycle a little bit. But I would encourage people just to go to cpaconline.com, cpakonline.com, because you can read about, you know, a little bit of my work, a little bit about some of the other scientists. This is really a collective process, a bunch of archaeologists, anthropologists, astronomers, people that are sort of going out on the fringe a little bit. We're all trying to figure out how this rise and fall of the ages works and what it means for us. So I'd tell people to get feedback on
it. Of course, the fringes are where the discoveries in the past have happened. And let me just chime in here about the CPAC conference. This is, Walter's being modest here. The group of people presenting at this conference are unbelievable. They are some of the most inspiring people that I've come in contact with. And coming in contact with Walter's work has led me to some of these others. It is no joke. If you really want to know what's perhaps some of the best information we know currently about our reality, I would suggest CPAC and its members is where you should look. And I definitely am going to be at the conference this year as a guest just to listen in and learn. So tell us about where we can find Lost Star of Myth and Time to purchase.
Probably the easiest way is just go to Amazon. So it's Lost Star of Myth and Time. You can either Google on that or Google on my name, Walter Cruttenden, Lost Star, and that'll probably take you there. And they have pretty good deals at Amazon.
Yeah, you can pick up the book for just a couple dollars, sometimes a couple pennies when you get some of the used ones.
Yeah, the used ones, right.
Okay, well, great. Walter, we're really honored to have had you on the show here. This is this radio show is only the 12th show, but I'm pretty determined to make this a screaming sensation. It's already getting some pretty good traffic due to a lot of accolades and endorsements I've gotten from people like Alex Jones and Dr. Bill Deagle, and there's been some things by Jeff Rentz and so forth. So this show will be in the archives at antimatterradio.com or bbsradio.com from now on. It'll be up probably later tonight or tomorrow morning at antimatterradio.com. So if everybody should tell their friends to download the information, listen to the information in this show with Walter, because this is very important in all my research and investigating reality since I was in really junior high when I really started getting into intensive research about things, becoming extremely curious about things. This is some of the best information I've ever come across. So if my word is anything to you, this is a very important radio show which everybody should know about and everybody should listen to. Your book, Walter, Lost Star, really should be, I think, a college textbook. And I don't know exactly which classes it would fit into because it's so comprehensive, it covers so much ground, but perhaps archaeology and anthropology would be a great place to bring it into college. Hopefully there are professors out there who will start to do that. And
well, if you enjoy history, it's a good book.
Walter, we got to wrap it up here. Walter, we're really honored to have you on the show, and I look forward to talking to you down the road, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff. Talk to you soon, and we'll exchange some names for other guests
good.
For you. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, great. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this edition of the Antimatter Radio Show. Don't forget to listen next week. We're going to have James Neinheis, author of Ice Age Civilizations, on the show. That's going to be unbelievable. And as usual, with the show, you get some of the most earth-shattering, incredible information you're going to find anywhere. We're really on a mission in this show to get to the bottom of things as best we possibly can. And I think today's show is a great example of that. So don't miss next week, and definitely share the information about this show with everybody you know. And go to the websites for the show, abstractatom.com or antimatterradio.com. You can buy Walter's book. If you go to antimatterradio.com, there's a little button on the left-hand side called Store. You just click on that, and you'll see Walter's book, Lost Star, right there. You can purchase it there if you'd like. And I'd like to thank everybody for listening.